All right, so tonight's night number three of the Shear series as we get ready for Purim. The first year we talked about Achashverosh, second year we talked about Vashti, and so tonight we're going to try to tackle Mordechai and Esther in one shear. So that's a little bit ambitious to tackle the two of them in one shear, but I think the main point we'll be able to get through. I've already begun getting ready for this because both in the Achashverosh shear and then really in the Vashti shear, we began highlighting some of the contrasts that the Megillah draws between those two personalities and particularly Esther. We saw the Medrash itself last week said, remember the pasuk from the fast of the Haftorah for the fast days, Tachas Yaleh Hadas, right? That Haman is replaced with Mordechai. And Vashti is replaced with Esther. In that context, we saw how Vashti and Esther have so much in common. Both of them orphaned both of orphaned women from a royal house. According to Chazal, Vashti was also orphaned at a young age. Both renowned for their beauty. Both, of course, married to Achashverosh. Both of them throwing parties. Both of them defying the will of Achashverosh. I think Esther and Vashti are the only two people in the Megillah who go against the law of the king. Vashti when she refuses to come, and Esther when she illegally comes. But that all culminated in the fact that at the end of the day, all those parallels highlight the one key difference between them. That is that when each one of them has the moment of crisis, each one of them has the moment where they are going to be forced to go against the will of the earthly king. So Vashti just went at it with her own pride, her own independent will, and she tries to pit her will and her personality and her power against that of Achashverosh. Did not work out. As opposed to Esther, who her experience was one of humility and bitachon, and when she knows that she's going to have to defy the king, so immediately she says, "Lech kenos es kol ha'yehudim. I can't do it by myself. I need all of Klal Yisrael with me." And the power which is going to make this successful is not going to be my charisma, my political ability, my yichus. It's going to be the fact that we're all going to be reaching out and fasting to Ribono Shel Olam for 3 days. So the real Vashti Esther relationship was there to highlight the element of Emunah and Bitachon, which is so critical to Esther's character, and we're going to further develop tonight. When we talked about Achashverosh, so there's another piece, really, really interesting, of contrast between Achashverosh and Esther. We saw that Achashverosh was all a bluff. Everything in Achashverosh's world was a facade, a deliberately crafted outward personality. Achashverosh was somebody who was showing what he shouldn't be showing. It's not normal to invite everybody into the inner recesses of your palace, to have everybody see all of your riches and treasures, and then finally to be showing off the beauty of your wife, the queen. And Chazal had Vashti telling Achashverosh, like, what are you doing? This is just absolutely not reasonable, civilized behavior. But Achashverosh is unable to keep secrets. Everything is being put out there. But at the same time, the irony is that the person who's constantly revealing, revealing, revealing is also putting up this this facade, this imagined perspective of this all-powerful king who has infinite wealth, infinite resources. The Megillah at the very end showed how that was all fake. Remember, yeah, it turns out you can't cut taxes and cut taxes and cut taxes and spend and spend and spend forever. Because finally, after pretending to have infinite wealth, Achashverosh ends the Megillah with having to raise taxes. Chazal's perspective of Achashverosh, that this was somebody who was not really biologically suitable for the throne, but he's presenting himself as such, someone who, beneath all of the bluster and confidence, was a really profound insecurity, almost bordering on paranoia of being assassinated, of being replaced, just like he had taken the place of the ruler before him. But that whole world of Achashverosh, where the front is all a facade, is also really completely contrasted with Esther. So I'm going to open the screen share now. With this, we'll begin looking at the source sheet. This will be a quick hit over here, but it's just worth us appreciating. Esther Number one, she never presents an actively false front. It's really, really interesting how she does it. Of course, the best symbol of this is that she doesn't put on any makeup or doesn't ask for anything. Lo biksha davar, kima shir yomar higai, sirisa mela. This image of, you know, on the one hand, Ahasuerush, who's putting on this whole show, and while every other woman in the palace is asking for this and asking for that, Esther is the only woman there in the whole perek who is not putting on a show, right? What you see is what you get. It's all natural. Now, at the same time, fascinatingly, even though Ahasuerush, you know, hides himself by presenting a false front, and Esther Dafka does not do that, Esther also hides herself, but in the exact opposite way of Ahasuerush. Esther specifically hides herself by concealing, by withholding, by holding things back. Lo higida Esther es ama ve'es moladata. Right? She didn't tell. Everybody wants to know, where is she from? Who's her nation? Where was she born? But again and again, the Megillah tells us Esther is a personality who has discipline. Esther is a personality who is able to hold things back. So while both Esther and Ahasuerush are great examples of what you don't know what's on, or you don't necessarily see the real person, the way the hiding is done, and of course hiding is such a massive theme in the Megillah, is completely, completely different. Ahasuerush hides by putting on a mask, by putting on a fake. You see a show, but it's not the real Ahasuerush. Esther hides, but dafka not through falsehood. There's nothing, there's no lie. There's nothing false about Esther. But with her discipline, she's just able to keep herself concealed, keep herself on the inside. In that regard, the way that Esther conceals herself is strikingly similar. It's virtually identical to the way HaKadosh Baruch Hu conceals himself in the Megillah. There's nothing fake or false, chas v'shalom, about the way Hashem behaves in the Megillah. His concealment is exactly the same as Esther. It's a concealment of withholding, of holding back. We do not see Hashem, obviously. We don't know where he is. He is hidden. It's not like there's something else. Oh, hey, look at the bread and circuses like we have with Ahasuerush. It is the same style of hiding. The Hester Panim of Ribono Shel Olam is done the exact same way as the Lo Higida Esther Es Omav Es Maladata, of holding back. Everybody desperately wants to know in the Megillah two things. Who is Esther? Where is Esther from? And they also want to know, where is HaKadosh Baruch Hu? And those are the two personalities in the Megillah, the human personality Esther and Hashem, obviously, who are behaving in the exact same way. So all in all, that's a very, very positive perspective on Esther. Not surprisingly, the contrast to Vashti, where Esther emerges as the personality of humility and faith, and the contrast to Ahasuerush, where they're both have hidden things, but the way Esther hides is the way that Hashem hides. And Hashem, of course, is, I want to deal with Yisrael, is that Hashem is truth. Esther is as well. Now, Mordechai and Esther are very much a team, you know, basically throughout the Megillah. And we're going to try to show in the next, the real main heart of the shiur is to understand that on the one hand, the Megillah builds up Mordechai and Esther as very, very much as a unit. But that unit that they have is also going to dramatize the moment of clash and the moment of break between them. Of course, not only are they both the heroes of the story, not only are they both royalty by the end of the story, we know they're both related. Esther is the adopted daughter of Mordechai. Chazal understand Esther may even have been the wife of Mordechai. The relationship between them is extremely close. And a way to highlight the link that they have is to show how the Megillah once again draws parallel links between both Mordechai and Esther and two essential personalities in Tanakh. The first is Yosef. For those who've been attending the Bereishis Shiurim, we kind of teased this for like 2 or 3 weeks, how pivotal Yosef is as a personality in the Megillah. Even beyond the specific links to Mordechai or to Esther, you know, thinking about the king who has a rough night and then wakes up, and then something dramatic happens, and then there's a total turning point. Ara with his dreams, and Ahasuerus with his news of what happened with Mordechai. What happened with Mordechai. But the specific links to Esther and to Mordechai are all over the Yosef story, throughout the Megillah. So just a couple of the specific textual links you have over here, right? Yosef, we know, finds favor through the eyes of anybody he meets when he's in Mitzrayim. And the exact same is the case for Esther, right? They both are exceptionally talented at finding favor. Esther finds favor in the eyes of everybody she meets before she becomes the queen. She finds favor in the eyes of the king himself. Both of them, we saw last week, have the identical description of being Yifei Tar Vifei Mar'et. Their beauty is described in the same way. Remember, we saw last week, there are only three people in Tanakh who have their beauty described this way, and they were Esther, Yosef, and Yosef's mother, Rachel. Both Esther and Yosef are, of course, they're young, orphaned people living in a hostile land, living under the rule of the greatest power of the day. They both rise to unimaginable heights. Both Esther and Yosef, of course, get names, right? They have different names. Esther's real name, or Hebrew name, is Hadassah. In Persia, all of a sudden she's known as Esther. Esther the Pshat is it. Esther is a Persian name, right? Like Ishtar, you know, the goddess of Persia. Of course, it's the Megillah, so, you know, everything is hidden. So the name Esther itself has a double entendre, you know. The Persians see the name Esther, and they're like, oh, Esther, that means Ishtar. What a good Persian girl. The Jews see Esther, and they say, ah, it means, you know, Hester, Panim, right? There's a reference there to being hidden. So even Esther's chosen Persian name has a double meaning, because there's so much that's concealed. But both Esther, with Hadassah and Esther, and Yosef, who gets the name Tzafnas Paneah from Paro, right? So they're both running around the country they begin isolated, young, orphaned. Esther loses her parents. Yosef loses his mother. And then for all intents and purposes, loses his father. They have the new name. Even the names are kind of related. I mean, Esther means hidden, right? Related to hidden. And Tzafnas Paneach means the revealer of the hidden, the revealer of secrets. They're both intermarried. You know, we don't really think about this so much in the context of Yosef, and Chazal have Midrashim to mitigate to some degree, but Esther is stuck living with Ahasuerus. It's hard enough to live a Jewish life in the best of times. She has to do it while being married to the king, being married to a Persian. Normally we think of intermarriage as the end of the line, but Esther is able to power through, and Yosef has the same thing. Vayitin lo asnas bas potifera kohin on isha. You know, Yosef is stuck, married. We have nice things to say about Asnas in Chazal, but in the Pasuk here, he's stuck married to some Egyptian, you know, daughter of a priest or daughter of an official. Yosef has to intermarry. And yet they're both able to retain their identities despite all the odds against them. And they also, just by the way, right, they're both throwing parties and getting people drunk. You know, Esther is getting Haman's throwing wine parties for Haman and Ahasuerus, and Yosef is throwing wine parties for his brothers, right? So there is a whole lot there from the specific words which are used for the two of them to the, you know, experience and trials that they have living isolated in a religiously hostile environment, and yet being able to maintain their bitachon and maintain their connection to the rest of Klal Yisrael. Mordechai, also many, many, many connections to Yosef. The most obvious one being that the two of them rise to become the Mishneh LeMelech. They both rise to become the second to the king. And the Megillah like goes out of its way to cut and paste. I mean, if I was a teacher and I was grading the Megillah for plagiarism, you know, you'd dock points for straight up plagiarizing pieces of Parshas Miketz over here. I mean, you actually wouldn't, because the Megillah wants to do that. It's like on purpose. But the Torah tells us that Paro takes his ring. He takes the ring off his finger and gives it to Yosef. And the Megillah uses the exact same line. Takes off the ring and gives it to Mordechai. So they've become second in command. And the way the Torah describes them becoming the second in command, or the Megillah describes them becoming the second in command, is done in the exact same way. What happens immediately after the ring is given? You get the fancy clothes. Paro dresses Yosef in the fancy linens, and he gives him the jewelry, and Mordechai has the exact same thing with Levush Malchus, Tcheles Vechor, Atara Zahav, right, jewelry for him as well, etc., etc., etc. Both Mordechai and Yosef are given the same public recognition, the same public display of honor. Yosef is driven around in the royal chariot. Mordechai is driven around in the royal horse. Yosef has people running before him saying, Avrech, Avrech, right? As he's riding, people are calling out his title, calling out his glory in front of everybody else. And you have Mordechai, the exact same thing, what's being called before him, now that's the happy times, you know, the parallels that that they have. But the, you know, what kind of drives it is the fact that how do they get to this spot? How did both Yosef and Mordechai get to this spot where they're being showered with rewards and with glory and with honor? It's because they were true to HaKadosh Baruch Hu when the chips were down. We saw last week when we talked about Vashti that there was one place in the Megillah where the Megillah linked Vashti's refusal to come before Ahasuerus with Yosef's refusal to come before the wife of Potiphar, which is very interesting. But here, the Megillah has the most obvious reference to Yosef and the whole Potiphar story. When the Megillah says about Mordechai's refusal to bow before Haman, Amram Elav Yom Yom Velo Shema Aleihem. Every single day, they would tell Mordechai, bow down to Haman, bow down to Haman, bow down to Haman. And he wouldn't do it. Never would. That is straight up lifted from the wife of Potiphar trying to get Yosef to sleep with her. Vayhi kedabra al Yosef yom yom. Vayhi ba'amram elav yom. Every day, day after day after day, the pressure is there. Velo shama aleihem. Mordechai doesn't listen to them. Velo shama eleha. Yosef doesn't listen to her. The sin of giloy arayos, of forbidden relationships. The sin of possibly Avodah Zarah. This helps see where maybe Chazal are getting some of this from, although we'll talk more about Avodah Zarah next week when we talk about Haman and Amalek. But the fact that they're able to remain true to their principles, remain true to their values and to where they come from, to the Masorah, under immense pressure, the daily pressure of just being nagged today and again today and again today, and knowing that beyond just the annoyingness of being nagged is that there is a massive personal risk to saying no. The wife of Potiphar is not somebody you want on your bad side if you're a slave, as Yosef knows, and then he experiences the hard way when she gets him thrown into a dungeon for a dozen years. And Mordechai with Haman is obviously also taking a massive chance by defying the rule of the king and not bowing down before Haman. We know that Haman wants to get him killed. But we have the core loyalty of Mordechai. Mordechai sticks to what he's supposed to do under pressure, just like Yosef did. Esther is able to maintain her Jewish identity despite everything around her and everywhere that she's stuck in her environment, just like Yosef did. So we can totally understand why the Megillah would want to hold Yosef up as the obvious person, the obvious role model, the obvious link for both Mordechai and Esther together. You are living in a world of gullus and you need to survive. How can you be in exile and yet stay true to everything that you come from? Yosef is the pole star, and both Mordechai and Esther totally together are following that to a T. And it goes one step beyond that as well, because Yosef, we don't really think about this so much when we learn Sefer Bereishis, but Yosef is the first generation of Klal Yisrael who does not experience prophecy. All of a sudden, after three generations, and Hashem reveals himself to Abraham many times, he reveals himself to Yitzchak multiple times, reveals himself to Yaakov, I think, seven times. And when Yosef is a kid and he's getting dreams from Hashem, and it seems like Yosef is going to be next in the long line of Nevi'im from the descendants of Avraham Avinu. And yet it doesn't turn out that way at all. Yosef never gets real Nevuah. his brothers never get Nevuah either. That whole generation not once receives a direct message from Hashem. If you look in the Chumash, all of a sudden Hashem's name falls out of Sefer Bereishis at the end. Parshas Miketz, Hashem's name doesn't appear at all. Half of Parshas, almost through the end of Sefer, basically the whole Sefer Bereishis, from the end of, the beginning of Miketz, with only one exception, which is when Yaakov says Hashem's name in one bracha, until the end of the Sefer, Hashem's name disappears. Because Bnei Yisrael are in Galus, they have entered exile, and exile is a time of Hester Panim. It's a time where Hashem's face is hidden. So it's not just that Yosef is able to maintain his bitachon, and he's able to maintain his identity in exile. He's also able to maintain faith in Hashem, specifically at a time where Hashem has suddenly seemed to disappear. And remember how Yosef, again and again, chalks up everything to Hashem. The dreams, that's coming from Kadosh Baruch Hu. The plan, the fact that I was sold as a slave to Mitzrayim, brothers, don't be angry. That's all the will of Hashem. I am a Yirei Elokim. He's able to sense Hashem's plan, Hashem's providence, even and specifically at the times when it is most difficult to find. And so there too, Yosef serves as the perfect religious role model for both Mordechai and Esther. So all in all, where Hashem is in their lives, what their pressures are, what their successes are, Mordechai and Esther are completely linked, looking to their not quite ancestor, but their great uncle, Yosef. Since Mordechai and Esther are both from Shevet Binyamin, they're not literally descended from Yosef, but they certainly have more closeness to Yosef than somebody who was from Shevet Yehuza or was from Shevet Levi or whatever. So that's major piece number one, Mordechai and Esther together. The other key personality who the Megillah links both Mordechai and Esther to, and Chazal are all over this one as well, not surprisingly, is Shaul HaMelech. Now, for Mordechai, the Megillah introduces Mordechai with giving you his genealogy. And we know, right, that he's a descendant of Kish, who is the father of Shaul. So the genealogy itself of Mordechai brings Shaul to mind immediately. And all you have to do, just a couple of Midrashim I'll cite right here, to see Chazal all over this one. So first, Rashi quotes right here when it comes to the bracha which Yaakov Avinu gives to Binyamin. Yaakov says that Binyamin is like a wolf who tears his food in the morning, he grabs his food in the morning, and then he divides the spoil in the evening. What does it mean, the morning and the evening? So the pshat of this is that a wolf does not do its hunting in broad daylight. A lion, Yehuda, hunts in the daytime. A wolf isn't that big. The wolf does its hunting in the darker hours. At the beginning of the morning and at the beginning of the evening, that is when the wolf comes out to hunt. And Rashi quotes a Medrash, which understands here, Binyamin's, the Shevet Binyamin's career being contrasted with that of Yehuda. So Rashi says, what is the Pasuk talking about? Ze'ev Yitraf Ba'boker, in the morning. So Rashi says, Al Shaul Hu Omer. The very beginning, when the first rays of Yisrael are beginning to come, the very first king, but he's a king under major pressure, major duress, the Plishtim are taking over like half the country, is still very young and just starting out. That is the era of Shaul. Then we have the time of day, and the time of day is the time of Malchus Beis David, the entire duration of the first Beis HaMikdash. And then after the early morning, which was Shaul, and the daytime, which is based of it, what do we have then in the evening? Yachalik Shalal, Mordechai, the Esther, Shehemi Binyamin, Yachalku es Shalal Haman. They divide up the estate of Haman. So you have the very bracha, which is being given to Binyamin, of emerging in the morning. And the evening refers to first Shaul, and then to Mordechai and Esther. Chazal have an even more dramatic link between Mordechai and Esther to Shaul, commenting on the pasuk here in Bamidbar Perek Kaf Daled. This is part of one of the brachos of Bilam. This is the Hinei Matov V'Manayim bracha from Bilam. And as Bilam usually does, it's a very mysterious pasuk. The pasuk says, Yizal Mayim Midalya. right? Midal Yav. So water will flow. So here they translate this from his branches, but we know that a dali is really can be a bucket. So I mean, water flows from his buckets. Vizaro b'mayim rabim, and his seed from many waters. Vizaro me'agag malko is going to be his king will be higher than Agag. Batinase malchusa, and then his kingdom will be established. What exactly is he talking about? So Chazal says something unbelievable. Says the Medrash Yalka Shimon. Yizal mayim midal yo zem malchuso shel Shaul. The water flowing from the bucket is the original kingdom of Shaul. Kedeli sheyesh lehafsek. A bucket has an end. You pour the water from the bucket, and it finishes pretty quickly. So the first part of the pasuk is the initial kingdom of Shaul. Then vizar'o b'mayim rabim, what's the seed has many, many waters. That's malchus beis David she'in lehafsek. Right? David's kingdom doesn't have an end. That part is not being compared to a bucket. It's being compared to many waters. Now, Vayidei ma paska malchus Shaul. What was it that ended the kingdom of Shaul? Ayidei Agag shenamar v'yerome Agag malko. Agag, the failure to kill Agag, right? Shaul held himself up over Agag, but it was the Agag affair which ends the kingdom of Agag. The af al pichin, even though Agag ends the kingdom of Shaul. Choseres v'nis'eis al yidei Esther. Esther will restore the lineage, the legacy of Shaul. Shenamar v'tinasei malchuso. The kingdom is going to be established. So the Medrash is seeing the failure. Right here we have both Esther and Shaul being linked. And now it's the failure of Shaul and atoned for with the success of Esther. There are a couple of phrases in the Megillah which do this pretty black on white. One is we saw last week where the Memuchan said to Achashverosh, so get rid of Vashti, and her kingdom, or her queendom, I guess, the king should give to her friend who is better than she is. Once again, we have a case of plagiarism over here, because this line, and I imagine Memuchan was probably not talking in Hebrew, but the way the Megillah took the words that Memuchan said in Persian and translates them into Hebrew, so the Megillah uses the exact phrase that Shmuel said to Shaul when Shaul had failed to kill Agag. And Shmuel had told Shaul that the kingdom is being taken from you, unsanat l'reacha hatov mimech, and the kingdom is being given to your fellow who is better than you. So what we have here is the Megillah giving us a wink of Esther being the tikkun, Esther being the repair for Shaul. Shaul failed to wipe out Agag, and therefore his kingdom was given to his friend who is better than he is. Now the tables are turned. Esther is now the friend who is better than the current queen, and she is being brought back in. And the Medrash Halakot Shemoneh is telling us, we know exactly what Esther is going to do. She is going to take care of business. We are going to wipe out Haman HaAgagi. At the end of the Megillah, right, this is the beginning of the Megillah. At the end of the Megillah, the Megillah does the exact same thing. It gives a hat tip to what happened with Shaul and his failure, and the tikkun under the leadership of Mordechai and Esther. Because under Shaul, what does Shmuel blast him for doing? You flew to the spoil. You ran for the money. You looked for the sheep. You wanted the riches. Right? The one commandment that you had, wipe out everything, hacharein, wipe them out. No holding anything for yourself. And Shmuel says, you disobeyed that command and you took the spoils for yourself. When Mordechai and Esther are leading B'nai Yisrael against the forces of Amalek, which we'll have to explore next week, so even though they were explicitly given written permission from Achashverosh, ushlalam lavoz, they had the legal authority to take the spoils, right? So Shaul was banned by Shmuel from taking the spoils, and yet he did so anyway. Mordechai and Esther are encouraged to take the spoils, and yet 1, 2, 3 times the Megillah tells us, Babizalo shalchu es yadam. 3 times, same phrase. They didn't take it. So again, we see the tikkun for Shaul. He ran after the spoil in killing Amalek. He didn't wipe out Amalek, but he took their money. Under Mordechai and Esther, Amalek is wiped out, but they leave the money behind. even though they didn't have to. So the descendants of Shaul, Mordechai and Esther, again being linked, are repairing the damage that was done by their ancestor, the failed first king of Binyamin. Truth is, the Ramban has a very interesting discussion in Parshas Vayechi. He tries to figure out, I understand, he says, Yaakov clearly blesses Yehuda with a kingship. So if Yehuda is supposed to be king, what would have happened if Shaul had not rejected the commandment of Shmuel? Let's say he had followed everything he was supposed to do. What would happen? Was he not going to be king? David is destined to be king no matter what. So I understand. If David is always destined to be king, half of the prophecies of Bilam clearly reference David. So why are we making such a big deal about Shaul's mistakes? His family wasn't supposed to be the kings anyway. So the Ramban explains, he has a couple of suggestions, but the main suggestion is that Binyamin really, over the long term, could have been in a Mishneh LeMelech role. They could have been second to the king. That whole family is very good at being second to the king. Yosef is the second to the king. He does a pretty good job. It's not a bad deal being the viceroy if you're good at it. But because Shaul fails, so not only does his house lose the kingship, they lose basically everything. There's no Mishneh LeMelech. Yonasan and David had planned on Yonasan being the Mishneh LeMelech. They had planned on Yonasan being the second in command, but because of the sins of Shaul, almost his entire household is wiped out, except for one surviving grandson who David saves, and it's a good thing he does, because as a result, we have Mordechai and Esther to save us. Now, even though that's what do Mordechai and Esther do? Especially Mordechai over here, he becomes the Mishneh LeMelech. He becomes the second in command that Shaul's family always was supposed to be. Right, that had been their ultimate destiny, and Mordechai pulls it off. He becomes the second to the king, to the king Ahasuerus. Now, there's one other area from Chazal. I haven't really seen this picked up, but I think it's a really interesting and important idea. One other area where we find Mordechai and Esther repairing the failure of Shaul. And this is one which honestly is not in the Pesukim at all. It is something which we basically only have in Chazal. And I think the framework we're setting up for thinking of Mordechai and Esther as repairing the mistakes of their ancestor helps understand where Chazal are coming from in this regard. We know the key religious theme of the Megillah is Hester Panim. Hashem's face is hidden. There's no prophecy. There's no nevuah. Hashem's name doesn't appear at all. Living in a world of galus, living in a world where we have to work and have faith that Hashem is running the show, but it's really, really hard to see. Shaul begins his career literally with nevuah smacking him in the face. He begins his career meeting Shmuel, the greatest Navi the Jews have had since the time of Moshe and Aaron. And Shaul himself becomes a Navi when he is in the process of becoming a king. He bumps into a group of Nevi'im, and then he gets prophecy along with them. The Navi says, "Yinei im Nevi'im Niba." Shaul prophesies along with the group of prophets we ran into. The people are stunned. Normally, it took years and years and years of spiritual effort to become a Navi. The Rambam talks about this at length in the Moreh Nevuchim. And yet somehow, Shaul jumps to the head of the line. All these students who've been in Shmuel's yeshiva, trying and trying and trying to tap into prophecy, and some of them finally succeeding, all of a sudden, Shaul bumps into them, and it's like he's the most natural prophet of all time. The people can't believe it. Vayimru'am isha re'ev. Ma'zaya leben kish agam Shaul ba'nevi'im. Look at Shaul. Shaul's a Navi. Look at Shaul the Navi. Now, that's Shaul at the beginning of his career. Nevuah everywhere. He himself is able to communicate with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. By the end of Shaul's career, because of his failures, because of his refusal to listen to the divine command, because of his refusal to take seriously the mitzvah to wipe out Amalek, what are we left with? We're left with a moment where Vayish'al Shaul Bashem, Shaul tries to seek out a message from God. V'lo ano Hashem, gam b'chalamos, gam b'urim, gam b'nivim. Hashem abandons Shaul. There is no prophecy. There are no dreams. There is no Urim Betumim. Hester Panim. Hester Panim is where Shaul ends his life. And then Shaul is reduced. He can't muster the bitachon to do what he's supposed to do anyway. He feels like he needs to get a message. And so he resorts to the world of Avodah Zarah and magic to try to revive Shmuel from the dead in order to get a prophetic message that way. He falls into the world of Avodah Zarah and dark magic. So Shaul then starts in a world of nevuah and ends in a world of terrible Hester Panim. Mordechai and Esther, we know, are living in a world of Hester Panim. Right? The whole Megillah is a world of Lo Ano Hashem, Gam B'Chalamos, Gam B'Urim, V'Gam Benaviyim. There's no answer from the dreams. There's no answer from the Urim. There's no answer from the Neviim in the Megillah. And yet, shockingly, what do Chazal say about Mordechai and Esther? So they say, Sheva Nevios, right? The Brisa says that there were 48 Neviim and 7 Neviot. Who were they? So the 7 Neviot, the Gemara says black on white. Sarah, Miriam, Devorah, Chana, Abigail, Huldah, and Esther. Fascinating. Apparently Esther rises to the level of prophecy. The whole world of Hester Panim that she experiences, and yet somehow she merits to receive full-fledged prophecy. Who are the 48 Nevi'im? So the Gemara actually doesn't tell you. You look at Rashi there on the Gemara, and Rashi quotes from the Gaonim. He quotes from the Baal Halachas Gedolos, who has a tradition from the Seder Olam Rabbah, right? So another source from Chazal, which lists all 48 of the Nevi'im, beginning with Abraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Moshe, Aaron, etc., etc., etc. This is one of those really interesting Rashis, because Rashi says there are 2 that I do not know. Another great example of a Lo Yadati Rashi, I don't know. But the last one who Rashi names is Mordechai. Apparently Mordechai also rises to the level of prophecy. So spiritually, Mordechai and Esther and Shaul are traveling in opposite trajectories. This is just a suggestion of mine, one piece maybe, about what Chazal are seeing over here. Part of the tikkun, you want a full repair for Shaul. So it's not just enough that we maintain faith even when it's difficult. It's not just enough that we take seriously what we're going to do with Amalek. Shaul began with Hashem close by, and all the actions he has destroys that. And then when he finds himself in a case of Hester Panim, he breaks religiously. As opposed to Mordechai and Esther, who managed to maintain the faith in the most difficult of circumstances. And not only can they maintain that faith, but Chazal are telling us that actually they ultimately succeed in bringing Nevuah back. There's actually one view in Chazal, it's clearly not this Rashi, but there's one view in Chazal that Mordechai himself is the same as Malachi. Malachi is the last of the Nevi'im, and it's very likely that Malachi was not Malachi's real name. I mean, is it a coincidence that the last Navi we ever have, his name is My Messenger? So the Gemara asks, who is Malachi? And the Gemara has 3 views. One view is that Malachi is Malachi. You know, that's who he was. One view is that Malachi was Ezra. But one view in the Gemara is that Malachi was actually Mordechai. So the very last of the Nevi'im may actually have been Mordechai himself, the person who brings back Nevuah and tells us at the end that one day it's all going to come back with Eliyahu HaNavi. So just taking a huge step back, I think actually it probably makes sense. It was probably a little ambitious to think we're going to do all of Mordechai and Esther in one night. I think we'll break the shear here and we'll tackle the rest of this next week. And then the week after that, we'll be able to do Haman and do Haman well. Where we're holding right now is we have Mordechai and Esther linked at basically every step. Every step of the way, they have the same challenges, they have the same triumphs, they have the same family, the same dark family history, the same mission to save Klal Yisrael, and the same family mission to restore the broken legacy of their ancestor. Shaul, who had so much potential and yet wasted all of it and ultimately destroys almost the whole family. Mordechai and Esther, working together at every stage, are able to build it all back. Just a tease, I guess, for next week, is that suddenly next week, we're going to see this unbeatable team of Mordechai and Esther suddenly falling out and suddenly being pitted against each other. We're going to have Mordechai coming to Esther in Perek Daled. Mordechai says we need to do something about Haman, and Esther refuses. Right? It's going to get pretty intense. But I think the best thing for us to do is just to hold off for now. So thanks everybody for coming to learn. And Ritz Hashem, next week we will finish off with Mordechai and Esther, and then we'll begin with Haman and Ritz Hashem.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Everybody. Next week everyone will get their names back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Everybody goes to